From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with British mystery writer P.D. James. Her novels, such as Death of an Expert Witness and A Taste for Death, have earned her a place as one of the genre's top writers. Also today, I talk with Leonard Maltin, film critic for Entertainment Tonight. He's just completed a new edition of his TV movie guide, featuring capsule summaries of over 17,000 films. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Days Away, the new album from vocalist Cassandra Wilson. And TV critic David Bianculli previews HBO's concert special of singer Billy Joel in the Soviet Union. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is British mystery novelist P.D. James. Her novel, A Taste for Death, is number one on the New York Times paperback bestseller list. Her novels, Death of an Expert Witness, Shroud for a Nightingale, and A Taste for Death, have been adapted for public television. James has helped advance the mystery genre beyond its fixation on whodunit. For instance, A Taste for Death delivers an intricately plotted mystery to solve, but it also asks readers to consider the subject of violent death and how everyone on the periphery of murder is irrevocably changed by it. James describes the bloody remains of murder victims with such clarity that her readers are often surprised to learn she is a 67-year-old grandmother who appears to live a calm, well-ordered life. She's been forced to be self-sufficient. Her husband returned from World War II disabled. She supported him and their children by working in different sections of the British civil service, including the police and criminal law departments. I spoke with P.D. James when A Taste for Death was first published. She told me why she writes in the detective genre.
Well, I suppose, Terry, I must really enjoy or be fascinated or perhaps even need the formal structure of the detective story. It seems to me that you have a framework which provides a kind of strength, and within that I can explore themes perhaps that I might not feel I wanted to explore outside the structure. I've given a lot of thought to this, and I think this must be the truth. I do love structure in a novel. I like formality, I like shape, I like organization in a model. And of course you do get that in the detective story.
Is there something liberating about working within a form?
Oh, I think it can be. You might imagine, you know, that the formula, because in one way there is a formula with the central mysterious death and the closed circle of suspects, and your detective, who must be either amateur or professional, comes in and solves the crime. The solution at the end of the book, which the reader should be able to arrive at himself by logical deduction, that is a formula in a sense. And sometimes people say, but this is formula writing. I don't think it need to be. What I think is interesting is that formula can be liberating of the creative imagination.
Do you think of yourself as belonging to a particular school within the genre of the detective novel?
I think I do. I think I'm very much in the Dorothy L. Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, to an extent, Nio Marsh tradition, which is the classical British detective story.
Which is what? What are the conventions of that form?
Very much, of course, as I've said, generally, with the death and the suspects and so on. But I think the form relies far more on characterization, on interest in motive, interest in people's relationships with each other, interest in the effect of murder on this group of people, the suspects, and to an extent on society itself, rather than on strong action, strong weaponry. I mean, we don't write the kind of mystery, the hard-boiled school, you know, when you have your sardonic, wisecracking private eye striding down the mean streets and kicking down doors and finding blondes and guns and bodies the other side of them.
But you're also not writing the kind of mystery where the whole focus of the novel is this intricate puzzle that the reader has to solve.
Not at all, no. This is, I think, the main way in which the modern mystery differs from the cozy mysteries of the 1930s. I mean, many of them were admirable, and I don't wish to knock them because they've given intense pleasure to many millions of people. But it seems to me that their ingenuity of plot, of method of death, and of the clues, these were dominant. And the characters on the whole were pretty pasteboard. I mean, they were just set up to be knocked down in the last chapter.
Would you put Agatha Christie in that category?
Oh, I think, oh yes. Yes, I certainly would. I think she was an extraordinarily ingenious fabricator of puzzles, a kind of literary conjurer. But, of course, with many of the puzzles, they don't bear a lot of thinking about because, you have your moment of surprise and think, my word, it's clever, it's brilliant. But if you go on to continue thinking about it, you realize that it couldn't possibly have worked in real life.
All writers who write about crime have to figure out how detailed, how explicit they want to make the death or the murder.
Mm.
And I'd like you to read a passage from your novel, The Taste of Death, in which the first person comes in who discovers the bodies that set the story in motion.
Yes, this is where poor Miss Wharton, this elderly church worker, has gone to the church to clean it and replace the flowers and finds the bodies in the vestry. And I suppose it is really rather horrific because murder is horrific. And I want my reader to feel Miss Wharton's terrible shock at what she finds. Brightly lit as on a stage, she saw the bodies still, more garish, more brightly lit than when they had first met her horrified eyes. One corpse had slipped from the low single bed to the right of the door and lay staring up at her, the mouth open, the head almost cleft from the body. She saw again the severed vessels sticking like corrugated pipes through the clotted blood. The second was propped, ungainly as a rag doll, against the far wall. His head had dropped forward, and over his chest a great mat of blood had spread like a bib. A brown and blue woollen cap was still on his head, but askew. His right eye was hidden, but the left leered at her with a dreadful knowingness. Thus mutilated, it seemed to her everything human had drained away from them with their blood, life, identity, dignity. They no longer looked like men. And the blood was everywhere. It seemed to her that she herself was drowning in blood. Blood drummed in her ears. Blood gurgled like vomit in her throat. Blood splashed in bright globules against the retinas of her closed eyes. The images of death she was powerless to shut out swam before her in a swirl of blood, dissolved, reformed, and then dissolved again. But always in blood.
I think what I especially like about that is the impact that the discovery of the bodies has on the woman who finds them, how overwhelming the contact with death is for her. And a little later on, you write how she is afraid that she's going to vomit or that she's going to lose control of her bowels before she can even get to a bathroom. And I don't think of rotting bodies and of this contact with the stench of death as being a standard part of the British crime novel.
No. I think Ruth Rendell writes realistically about death, but it certainly isn't typical, really, of some of the best-known writers. In Agatha Christie, there's hardly any description of the corpse at all. In fact, I think in one book, I can't remember which one it was, we are told, that it was killed by a blow to the head, and then later, I think, some other method of death, almost as if she really couldn't face the actual description of the body. She didn't want to write about it. She didn't want to think about it. And certainly Dorothy L. Sayers, whom I admire very much, is not very explicit about the actual corpses, is she? I think I'm trying to write a realistic novel. And murder is uniquely horrible. And I think that this shock of finding the bodies is important, really. The reader should feel it.
Well, I think that the passage that you just read not only sets the story in motion, but it sets another theme of your novel in motion, which is how awful it is to confront death.
Yes, to confront violent death, absolutely. And I think the novel deals with the effect of violent death, of murder, on everyone who comes in contact with it or who is involved with it. Dalglish thinks of it as a contaminating crime, and indeed it proves to be so that we see it by the end of the book that nearly every life has been changed, including Miss Wharton's, of course.
Do you think that the form of the detective novel lends itself well to writing about larger themes, which is what you're doing within the form?
Well, I think it does for me. I don't think it does for everyone. The mystery, the word mystery, if we're using the American expression, which after all is a very good expression because it is about mystery, about a mysterious death. It embraces such an extraordinary variety of books, doesn't it? And I think many of them, even today, are written primarily as puzzles, not perhaps quite in the way they were in the 30s, but primarily as puzzles. And maybe the writers aren't particularly interested in any wider or deeper themes, but I think I am. I don't know when I begin the book that I consciously think this is going to be a book about guilt, or this is going to be a book about the effect of murder on a particular society of people. But inevitably, before I'm halfway through, the theme does emerge, and it's usually a theme in which I'm intensely interested.
The clues have to be fair in a detective novel, fair to both the detective and fair to the reader. What's out of bounds?
Oh, I think too great a coincidence. You see, what's interesting to me is that coincidence frequently happens in real life. We know in our own experience extraordinary coincidences happen. And they do, I think, very often in real life, investigation of murder. But somehow it isn't right in the mystery. We shouldn't rely on an extraordinary coincidence. And I think that the clues have got to arise naturally from the circumstances of the book and the people, the characters, and not sort of be inserted rather artificially as if they're sixpenny pieces and a plum pudding, you know, ready for the reader to pull out triumphantly and hold aloft and say, here's another clue. They must arise naturally, because they can be material clues, the obvious ones like handkerchiefs, buttons, cigarette ends. They can be the absence of something. Gardener working in the garden, yet there aren't any footprints in the beds. The dog that didn't bark in the night. They can be largely scientific, body fluids, blood, of course. And they can arise from character. Those are probably the most interesting. The way in which people behave at one particular time, behaving out of character, apparently.
You can't do anything like introduce a secret passageway at the end of the novel or have a twin brother come in who actually committed the crime, throwing everything off.
Oh, absolutely not. No. You could have a twin brother, of course, if the reader knew from the beginning that there was a twin brother. You can have a secret passageway if the reader knows from the beginning that this is a very old house and it's got a secret passageway. But both, I think, have been overdone, really, in the mystery, the twin brother and the passageway.
Do you have a rule of thumb? Does nearly everybody or does everybody in the novel have to be a suspect?
No, not necessarily. But I think one of the problems of writing the mystery is the number of characters you have to introduce. Because you obviously have a detective, and he's extremely important. In one way, he's the main character. You have your victim. Then if you're going to have a puzzle, it's intriguing, you probably need about three or four suspects. So already you've got four, five, six major characters. So in a way, from a technical point of view, you can't afford to have too many characters who are not playing a fairly important part in the book, you know, unless they're just extraneous walking on parts, as it were.
Should the reader be able to solve the crime before the detective does?
Oh, I think so, yes. One hopes that the reader won't, but very often in my books, the reader knows more than the detective does, because I will have a scene when two suspects perhaps are talking together and admitting things to each other, which they certainly aren't going to admit to Dalgliesh when he interviews them. So in a sense, the reader can be a little ahead of Dalgliesh.
Well, it's interesting, because the reason why the reader can do that is because you're writing in third person as opposed to a first person narrative told from the detective's perspective.
Yes, I think that's too restricting.
First person's too restricting?
Oh, I think so. Yes, because you're quite right. I mean, if you write it from the point of view of your detective, the reader can only see what he sees, hear what he hears, experience what he experiences. And I think the novel is more complex and more interesting if the reader can enter into the minds and thoughts of other characters. So I usually see the story through several eyes, shifting from one character to another. And this also has the advantage that sometimes you can deal with virtually the same event and see it through two entirely different eyes, and see how in life one seemingly fairly simple event can present itself in two entirely different ways, depending on who is noticing, who is there, who is perceiving it.
In detective novels, the crime, the murder, usually introduces fear and disorder into the world. And then it's the detective's job to set things right again and to recreate a balance, to recreate order. I think that you violate that in a way, because at the end of the book, things aren't back to their state of order and balance again. People have been irrevocably changed.
Mm, this is true. I think, and this is one other way, really, in which the modern mystery can differ. You still have a solution. I think unless you had a solution at the end, it really wouldn't be a mystery. It wouldn't be written within the genre, to use a word I don't like, but it's the only word I think we can use. It might be a crime novel, but it wouldn't be a detective story. So you have to have the solution. But you nowadays seldom have a complete restoration of order, as you used to in the days of Agatha Christie and Mayhem Parva. There was this wonderful little village, you know, in which everybody, whether they were the parson or the doctor or the chemist or the district nurse or the squire, moved like figures on a chessboard, and this disruptive crime happened, and then, as you say, order was restored. And certainly in my novels, order isn't restored, or not necessarily so, because the innocent can suffer more than the guilty.
My guest is British mystery novelist P.D. James. We'll continue the interview after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Novelist P.D. James is my guest. The detective, the American detective novelist Robert Parker, once told me that he thought one of the differences between the American detective novel and the English detective novel was that the English novel assumed that the regular state of being was order, the murder introduced disorder, and the detective could restore order again. Mm. Whereas the American hard-boiled detective novel assumed that chaos and irrationality was the normal state, and maybe a detective could create a little order for a temporary period, but then order, disorder and chaos would rule again. And I wonder if you find any truth in that.
Oh, I do. Yes, indeed I do. Certainly if we're looking, you know, again back to the novels of the 30s when Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler were writing, and if we look at the rather cozy English mysteries of the same period. The American one does give the impression that there is a society in a great state of flux, not a homogenous society, a violent society, and that the detective is, as it were, a lone crusader, and that his fight is as much against the police, whom he sees really almost as the agents of a corrupt society, as it is against the villains. And then if we look at the English mystery, there you have what appears to be a very ordered society, a very hierarchical society, a common view of law and order. And although the police are often buffoons and they're mere foils, you know, to the brilliance of the amateur detective, they're never violent and they're never corrupt. Now, of course, I think we're more realistic and we realize the police are unlikely to be notably any better than the society from which we recruit them. This is one of the other differences between the 1930s novel and the present one. But he's perfectly right. I would absolutely agree that those two mysteries almost represented interesting aspects of the two societies in which they were written. Because Raymond Chandler disliked the cosy British mystery very much, and I forget the name of the essay that he wrote about them. It's a very brilliant essay, but he did make the comment that the English may not be the best writers in the world, but they're the best dull writers. he was thinking, of course, of these very gentle mysteries.
Which do you prefer to read?
Well, I prefer to read the English, perhaps, not surprisingly, but I have a great admiration for the American writers. I think, on the whole, especially again if we're thinking of the 30s, they are far the better writers. I don't think there's any comparison. I mean, Raymond Chandler is a very fine novelist, so is Ross Macdonald, and infinitely finer novelist than Agatha Christie could ever be. Finer novelist than Nia Marsh.
Another difference, I think, between the English tradition and the American hard-boiled tradition is the constant wisecracking.
Yes.
That the American detective does.
Yes, yes. There's some notable one-liners out there, really.
And sex, too, because American detectives tend to have probably more active sex lives and get involved with glamorous but mysterious women of questionable motives.
Yes, but again, I'm thinking here of Dashiell Hammett, I suppose, and Raymond Chandler. and their attitude in the books to women, the women really seem to me to be either just performing some fairly lowly function. I mean, they're telephonists or they're stenographers or they're receiving the hero when he goes to visit the great man in his office, or they are dangerous and evil. Very dangerous and evil. I remember many sort of professional, hard-working, successful young women in those books. And the hero may be indeed extremely attracted, but you feel that he knows he's being attracted to something which he shouldn't really touch because it is going to corrupt him and be evil.
My guest is novelist P.D. James. Have you ever, as your characters do, stumbled upon a murder or suddenly discovered a body, anything like that?
No. Never, no.
Have you met anybody who has, or did you know anyone who's been the victim of violence?
Not that kind of violence, no, never. Of course, I've spoken to policemen who investigate murder and when I'm doing my research, but I've never. Murder in England is still a comparatively uncommon crime. I think last year we had, 530 homicides, which include manslaughter, so they weren't all murder, and only 14% of those were deaths in which the victim wasn't known to the murderer or to the killer. So it's still pretty uncommon. I mean, that's less than some American cities have in a year. And I would be a bit surprised, I suppose, if I did meet someone who had known a case.
You've always written under the name P.D. James. Your first name is Phyllis. Did you use the initials so that people wouldn't know you were a woman, or they wouldn't know what sex you were?
Well, I don't know, Terry. I don't think consciously I did, but, you know, goodness knows what goes on in the subconscious of a crime novelist. I can remember having no doubt at all that I wanted to write under my maiden name, not under my own family name and not my married name. And it was a choice of, therefore, having Phyllis James, Phyllis D. James, or P.D. James. And I thought, you know, the last is short and it's slightly enigmatic, slightly mysterious. I just preferred it. And now, you know, when I've just done the signing of 300 books, I'm rather grateful that I chose P.D. James, I must say.
Less writer's cramp at those book signings.
Yes, less writer's cramp.
Do you think that if you'd used your name Phyllis and if people knew right from the start that you were a woman, that your sales would have been any different?
I don't think at all, because, you see, with this kind of writing in particular, women have quite a high reputation. It's not as if I were attempting to write a fast action thriller, you know, to do with guns and midget submarines and war. And I mean, I'm not competent to write such a book. I never would wish to. But supposing a woman did want to write such a book, then I can see that possibly writing it under a feminine name might be a disadvantage. But I don't think writing a classical detective story would be.
You thank the forensics unit of the police in the beginning of your book for all the help that they gave you. What kind of help did you ask them for?
Oh, particularly on bloodstains. This is the difference between real life and detective fiction, because very often in the old books, you know, the body would be, the autopsy would be done by the village doctor on his table after dinner, and he'd immediately next morning or straight away say, well, this is so-and-so's blood. Because in real life, it takes about 3 days to get this result. I wanted to find out, too, how exactly the examination of the scene is done. So I went to see the forensic biologists at the lab. And interestingly enough, the senior biologists are women, and very brilliant they are.
Have you sat in on autopsies?
No, no. I've never felt I needed to. I use a book by a forensic pathologist, Professor Keith Simpson, who is a very famous pathologist. And vastly experienced in murder, of course. And this is a textbook, really, for medical students, and I can get all the information from it I need. I've never felt I needed to watch an autopsy.
Would you have the stomach for it if you did?
If I really needed to watch an autopsy in order to write the book properly, I would watch it. But I would never watch it out of curiosity. I don't think that's right.
Do you think you'd make a good detective?
Yes, I think I would. I don't know how good I'd be at the duller part of the investigation. I mean, so much of it is plodding from door to door, and this is so vitally important. But I think women, on the whole, are underused in the detective force, because I think we are much cuter about people. I mean, I think women can tell when another person is lying much more easily than men. And in some real-life crimes that one has read, I found myself thinking, well, how on earth could they have been taken in by that story? And that if a woman had been there, she would have known that that was a lie, that it had to be a lie.
You have very complicated plotting, which is just a part of the book. How do you organize the plot? Is that all done before you actually sit down and write chapter one?
Oh, yes, it is, Terry. There are different ways, aren't there, of writing crime fiction. I mean, we are told by Simenon that he, in fact, just chooses the names of his characters from the international telephone directory, locks himself in a room, puts them into a situation, and lets them get on with it. But I can't do that because of the kind of book I write, which is so closely plotted and so structured. I need to know exactly where I'm going, so that researching the book and plotting takes about as long as writing. And I do have notebooks, I have charts. It all worked out very closely, really, before I begin. And yet, mysteriously, it does change during the telling.
Would it make you really angry if I told all of our listeners who did it in your book? I mean, how important would that be? I'm not going to do it. But how important would that be to you?
Well, Teddy, who knows? They might hear over the phone a terrible gurgling scream as I fastened my hands around your throat. I hope not. I hope not. Well, how important is it? Well, this is interesting, isn't it? I mean, obviously, I think people don't want to be told. Obviously, they're reading it partly for the puzzle. But what is interesting about the mystery is that the ones I really enjoy, I reread. I mean, the actual solution to the crime can't really be so dominant, can it? Because if it were, we would never reread. And we do reread our favourites. We know perfectly well who did it. But I don't think we want to know in advance of the first reading. That's for certain.
I'd better be careful then.
Oh, you had better be very careful.
I know a lot of people have commented that it seems almost ironic that here you are writing these novels, these mystery novels with rotting corpses and people whose lives are irrevocably changed by violence. And you are a very, controlled, probably pretty orderly woman, an older woman who seems to have great control over your life, and you're not probably the adventurous sort.
No. No, I don't think I am, Terry. Quite right.
So does this seem like a great contradiction to you?
Well, maybe, some way in which I exorcise what I think is quite a deep-rooted fear of violence on my part. I'm frightened of violence. I dislike violence. I do love good order, good social order, good psychological order. I don't like messy lives. I think this is perfectly true. Of course, none of us can be totally in control of our own life, and if we think we are, then all sorts of horrible little things jump out at us around the next corner, don't they? But I do like a fairly ordered life, fairly structured life, yes. This is true.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been very interesting, Terry. Thank you.
My guest has been British mystery novelist P.D. James. Her latest book, A Taste for Death, is number one on the New York Times paperback bestseller list. It's published by Warner Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Father Niall O'Brien. He's a missionary priest who has lived and worked in the Philippines for over 20 years. He was imprisoned under the Marcos regime, but has continued his work under the leadership of Corazon Aquino. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, film critic Leonard Maltin talks about the latest edition of his guide to movies on TV and video, 17,500 entries to help viewers separate the great films from the bombs. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Days Away, the new album from singer Cassandra Wilson. And television critic David Bianculli previews Billy Joel from Leningrad, USSR, the upcoming HBO special of Joel's recent Soviet concert tour. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
Pandemonium on Wall Street today. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 470 points today. Official figures on the closing Dow average won't be available for some time because of the huge record volume today. About 580 million shares changed hands. Market analyst Alan Ackerman says a number of political and economic trends have combined to cause today's slide.
The confrontation in the Persian Gulf bodes poorly for the United States and for oil prices. The second thing is we're looking at interest rates that are concerning people, and the fact that in the World Economic Mechanism, higher West German rates are beginning to siphon investors from U.S. dollar-based investments. So I think that we're looking at a series of negative events here, and people are compounding them in a panic state.
The financial picture was bleak on international markets as well. Stock prices dropped on the London Stock Exchange, tripling the previous one-day record. Stock prices fell 11% in Hong Kong. An Iranian official says Washington is now involved in a full-fledged war with Iran. The reaction follows a U.S. strike in the Persian Gulf this morning. Four U.S. ships destroyed the two platforms of one Iranian rig, and naval forces temporarily boarded a second rig, destroying weapons, communications, and radar equipment they found there. U.S. Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger said the two platforms shelled by U.S. ships were being used as a base to launch small boat attacks on tankers and had been used to fire on a U.S. helicopter last week. He said the 30 or so Iranians manning the rig were given time to get off before the shelling started.
The Iranian personnel on board, we believe somewhere between 20 and 30, were given sufficient warning time, 20 minutes, prior to the attack, that the attack was coming, and to abandon the site. And they did, so far as we know, abandon the site.
President Reagan said the U.S. does not want a military confrontation with Tehran, but he said the Iranian government should be under no illusions about U.S. determination and ability to protect American ships and interests in the Persian Gulf. On Capitol Hill, lawmakers from both parties supported the U.S. action in the Gulf, but there is still a difference of opinion about whether the War Powers Act should be applied. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Congressional leaders give the administration high marks for calling them to the White House last night to consult about retaliation against the Iranian attack on a U.S.-flagged vessel last week. Democratic and Republican leaders termed it a measured, appropriate response and said no one at last night's White House meeting opposed the U.S. attack. President Reagan has promised to notify Congress about the action, but it's expected he will not use the language of the War Powers Act to do so. And the senior Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Michigan's William Broomfield, argued today it would be a mistake to invoke the law because it would send the wrong signal to the Iranians. The chairman of the committee, Florida Democrat Dante Fussell, gave the opinion that Congress would probably simply sign on to a resolution supporting the action in the Gulf. But the Senate is still considering applying the War Powers Act, and a vote on an amendment to the measure is scheduled for tomorrow. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
Bernard Goetz was sentenced today to 6 months in jail and 5 years probation for possession of the gun with which he shot four black youths on a New York City subway train almost 3 years ago. The judge also directed Goetz to undergo psychiatric treatment. And the longest-serving member of the U.S. Senate announced today that he will not seek another term. Mississippi Democrat John Stennis has held his seat since 1947. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from singer Cassandra Wilson. Wilson is based in New York, where she often works with a group called Five Elements, a kind of new wave jazz funk group drawn from the New Brooklyn avant-garde. Here's a sample from the new album, Days Away.
I reached for the star and got moving. I reached for some starlight. To try and get away. Anyway, I reached for some starlight and got some moon glow. Jupiter folks had apricots on their wings.
To my ears, Cassandra Wilson is the best new jazz singer to come along in over a decade. She's absorbed some of Sarah Vaughan's grit and Abby Lincoln's exquisite feel for drama and shading. She doesn't really sound like either. Wilson's blessed with perhaps the most beautiful instrument of any singer in jazz, a limber, smoky voice, strong even at a low purr. She sounds at once sexy and playful, emotionally committed and intellectually detached, and very sure of herself. Cassandra Wilson may not like being tagged as a jazz singer at all. She's one of those younger musicians for whom rock, not jazz, was the pop music of her youth, so it'd be surprising if she didn't allow a rock strain into her music. On her new album, Days Away, on Germany's JMT label, Graham Haynes' trumpet and Steve Coleman's saxophones vie with Jean-Paul Borelli's Hendrix-flavored guitar for lead instrument. Wilson herself moves directly from mock Joan Armatrading reggae to a breakneck take on Irving Berlin's Let's Face the Music.
Trouble ahead, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance. Before the fiddlers have fled, before they ask us to pay the bill, and while we still have the chance, let's face the music and dance. Oh, soon we'll be without the moon, humming a different tune, and then there may be teardrops to shed, but while there's moonlight and music and love and romance, let's face the music and dance.
Now, despite what we're told, there's nothing new or daring about mixing jazz, rock, and Tin Pan Alley pop. Bad lounge bands all over the world do that every night of the year. What's different about Cassandra Wilson is that she does it well, mixing genres in order to borrow strong points from each. Part of the credit goes to her gifted collaborators, including pianist Rod Williams and writers and arrangers Henry Threadgill and Olu Dara. But Wilson wrote and arranged much of Days Away's best, confirming that her own taste is her music's strongest suit. She's not just a great singer with respect for melody and supple rhythm. She also has a sly sense of humor. I'm not quite sure if we're to take You Belong to You at face value as a lesson in self-reliance, or as a wicked send-up of smug Vegas anthems like My Way.
Let the world know who you are. Keep it simple, keep it true. You belong to you. Someone said that the world was round when I swore it was flat. Now I find the truth of it depends on where I'm at. No one ever promised me my dreams would all come true, so I know that I'm the only one to see them through. Have a free and happy heart. Let the world know who you are. Keep it simple, keep it true. You belong to
You'd be hard-pressed to name another singer who can redeem self-help schmaltz the way Cassandra Wilson does with You Belong to You. Just imagine, if you dare, Sammy Davis Jr.'s version. Wilson has the good sense to keep her ironic distance. She earns your confidence in her taste. So if she wants to keep stretching her stylistic range and maybe make some money in the process, that's okay with me. Still, no American has ever had a crossover hit while recording for a German jazz label. If any of the New York crowd deserve a major label breakout, it's Cassandra Wilson. She wouldn't have to change to be successful and would likely trust her own instincts more than any corporate producers.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat, Cadence, and Jazz Times. He reviewed Cassandra Wilson's new album, Days Away, on the JMT label.
I fell in love. Neath the old magnolia tree, yeah. When a firefly flew past your eyes, I said, I'm gonna catch it, put it in a jar.
You're listening to Fresh Air. My guest is Leonard Maltin. He reports on film for the TV show Entertainment Tonight, but film buffs know him also as the author of Leonard Maltin's TV Movies and Video Guide, which he's edited since 1969. The new 1988 edition lists more than 17,000 movies that are likely to show up on television. Each entry includes a capsule summary, running time, the film's director and leading actors, year of release, and whether it's available on home video. Maltin told me that he and his staff of devoted moviegoers continually have to update and revise the guide.
We who work on it call it the book that never ends, because it's not just a matter of keeping track of the new movies and seeing them and writing them up, but also keeping track of the kind of little nitty-gritty details that turn up, not only with the new movies, but of course with older movies or even recent movies and the way they get treated on television or dealt with on videotape. So it's just an ongoing job that could only be done by people who really love movies.
When you started this book, you were 17 years old. How did you end up getting a job like that?
I was literally in the right place at the right time. I had been publishing and editing a little film buff magazine when I was in my teens. And a high school teacher of mine got me an introduction to an editor at New American Library in New York City. And it was just supposed to be a social introduction. She said, I think the two of you would really enjoy meeting each other. So I went to see him, and of course, with ideas dancing in my head that maybe I could write a book for him sometime. And I brought copies of my magazine. And when he saw it, he said, is that your magazine? I said, yeah. He said, oh, I love it. And he'd seen it before. He knew it very well. And that kind of broke the ice. And he was looking for somebody to do this kind of book. And 3 days later, we were making a deal for me to do it. But he didn't have the nerve to tell the publishing house that he was hiring a 17-year-old kid to do it. So he wrote the contract out to Film Fan Monthly, which was the name of my magazine. And that way my father didn't have to countersign for a minor.
How many of the movies do you see yourself that are in The God?
I haven't ever counted. Obviously, being the boss, being in the top position, it gives me the privilege of choosing what I want to review. And so I try to review everything I see, and I see a lot of movies. I see 5 or 6 a week, old and new.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm pretty dominant in this book, but at the same time, no one person could review everything because no one can see everything that comes out. And that's why I'm lucky to have a staff of people with me who are all, you know, really dedicated and intelligent movie watchers and movie writers.
Have you revised any of your earlier ratings in your new volume? Is your new volume any different in its star ratings or in its review of the movie?
Yeah, we go back all the time. If I'm channel flipping and I come upon a movie that I haven't seen in a while and I watch it again, or if I go to a film festival or a revival and I see a movie again I haven't seen in a long time, I find quite often my opinion may differ. It may not be a drastic change, but there may be certain things about the film that strike me differently or that don't hold up the way I thought they did. And this is true for the other people who work with me on the book. We all have that experience. And we feel it's important to have fresh opinions in the book. To have, if it's a 1987 or 88 book, they should be 1988 opinions. They shouldn't be 1968 opinions.
Is there an example of a movie that you caught on late night TV that made you revise your opinion?
Well, I can't think of one specifically. I can tell you that one thing that has happened to me is that the more I go back to certain old movies, the better and better they look. This is kind of a phenomenon, I think, of our time, that so many films that come out these days leave you wanting, that when you go back to a Hitchcock or you go back to a great comedy or you go back to one of those personality vehicles for a Bogart or a Gable or whoever it may be, you say to yourself, gee, this is just so entertaining. Why carp? You know, why was I being so, you know, so stingy in my praise for this? It may not be a great movie, but compared to so much of what you see today, it's just so entertaining. So I find that I keep increasing the ratings on a lot of those older films because they just look better and better with age.
Well, I'm still waiting for you to increase your rating of Taxi Driver, which you give 2 stars and you describe it as ugly and unredeeming. Maybe next year it'll get 3 or 4, huh?
All right, I promise that I'll look at it again. I give you my word, I will look at it again.
One of the things that's very handy about your guide is that it gives a running time for each movie that's on TV. And it's very helpful to see if the TV station is cheating when they're running the movie. They frequently cut the film so that they could fit it into their 90-minute or 2-hour slot and still have time for commercials. I've heard some pretty grisly stories about what TV stations sometimes do to shorten those movies. What are the truths about that? Do you know, are TV stations very insensitive when it comes time to shorten a movie to fit it into the time slot?
I've witnessed some horror stories, and I've heard some horror stories about that. And you'd think that wouldn't be done much anymore. But now even the networks do it. They just don't like a movie to run an odd time. They don't want it to run 2 hours and 10 minutes or, you know, 1 hour and 47 minutes. They want it to come out even. As to what's happened in the past, I hope we'll never see this kind of thing again. I once watched Singin' in the Rain on New York television on a 4:30 movie where they just cut whole musical numbers. They just cut them, whacked them right out. And one time I watched Anchors Away, which I'd never seen. I was young, and I wanted to see this because I'd always heard about that great sequence where Gene Kelly dances with Jerry the Mouse, the animated mouse. It wasn't there. And the reason is that, you know, when an editor's got to quickly, and he never has much time, cut those films for local TV broadcast, the easiest thing to cut is a musical number. It doesn't interfere with the plot. Oh, dear. I mean, the things they would do.
In your new guide, you indicate which movies are now available on home video. Is there any logic behind what is being released? Who makes the decision?
The decisions are made by marketing people, I guess, mostly, because there doesn't seem to be any logic, Terry. None at all. The number of wonderful movies that aren't available on home video is staggering. Absolutely staggering. Great films. Not just films that are great because I or you or some film buff says they're great, but films that still have staying power, that have reputations. The Oxbow Incident, with Henry Fonda, or Young Mr. Lincoln with Henry Fonda, which you'd think there'd be a ready audience for. Those are a couple of examples that I just realized recently weren't out. Of course, there are some legal complications keeping some films away, like The Last Picture Show has so much music in it. And when they made that film, they never reckoned with home video and didn't buy the rights to those songs to play it on home video. So they've had to try to worm their way around a tough negotiation there. Same thing with John Sayles' film, Baby, It's You. You know what they've done with a film like The Breakfast Club or 16 Candles, where there were so many songs on the background, soundtrack, is in some cases when they went to negotiate those rights to put it out on home video and the publisher held out for a lot of money, the studio just said, well, the heck with it then. We'll put in some other songs on the soundtrack. And that's what they did. So the home video version actually has some different music in it.
Talk about integrity.
Yeah, exactly. It's again, Terry, you know, it's amazing how many films just get treated still these days as product.
Do a lot of newspapers steal your listings and use them for their Sunday TV guide supplements?
Steal is such a harsh word. Obviously, you know, this is a reference book and it's meant to be referred to. So I know that almost every newspaper person I've ever met tells me that they use my book to do their TV listings, and it's meant for that, so that's fine. Once in a while, they use it a little too assiduously.
Your book used to be the TV movie guide edited by Leonard Maltin, but now that you're on TV, your name's above the credits, and it's Leonard Maltin's TV Movies and Video Guide, and there's a picture of you, too, now that you have a recognizable face.
That is the single most satisfying result of my being on television, bar none. People say, how did television change your life or what's different? I say, what's different is I got a call one day from my publisher saying they wanted to put my name above the title and my picture on the cover. And I said, to think that I lived long enough to see that happen.
You know, when I use your book or my friends, we call it Maltin. Like, look it up in Maltin. I think you're becoming a brand name. Not a brand name, but what do you call it? Like if
generic?
Somebody, generic, yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Like if someone calls a tissue a Kleenex.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very honored. I think that's very nice.
Well, happy movie watching, and thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Terry.
Leonard Maltin is the editor of Leonard Maltin's TV Movies and Video Guide, published by New American Library. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Brenda Wilson, who is co-hosting today's program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Brenda.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
We have two big stories for you today. The first is on the retaliation by the U.S. against Iran in the Persian Gulf. And we'll hear about the action and get reaction from Congress and military experts. And we'll also take a look at the stock market, which is experiencing wild fluctuations. We'll hear about a new translation also of the Book of Job, restoring it to its original sense of verse, and how the book deals with the existence of evil in the world.
Thanks, Brenda. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Singer Billy Joel made headlines this summer when he and his band performed in the Soviet Union. You can see one of those concerts on cable TV this weekend. Critic David Bianculli has this review.
Cable TV cranks out dozens of music concerts each year, but only a few are good enough to deserve special attention. This Saturday, HBO has one. It's the third edition of HBO World Stage, and it's called Billy Joel from Leningrad, USSR. In the other two World Stage programs, it was the performers that made them worth watching. Cyndi Lauper in Paris, Ringo Starr, George Harrison, and others in London. In this one, Billy Joel really knocks himself out, but what's amazing is to watch how the Russian audience reacts to him. Even if you don't like concert films or rock and roll, Billy Joel from Leningrad is worth checking out. Think of it as high-energy glasnost, and a brief connection between two usually separated groups. When Joel returned from his August tour, he complained a bit about how stuffy the audience was in Moscow, but raved about the kids in Leningrad. To overcome the language barrier, Joel compensates with more physical acrobatics than an Olympic team. He does backflips off his piano. He runs across the stage and dives on his piano. He stretches face down on top of it and spins around faster and faster, like a one-man Busby Berkeley movie. He strips off his coat, shoes, and socks and throws them into the outstretched arms of the crowd. Then he throws himself into the outstretched arms of the crowd and lets them carry him aloft like a beach ball. Oh yeah, and while all this is going on, he's singing too. A translator is on hand to help Joel with the introductions to his songs, and Joel takes the opportunity to deliver some fairly potent messages.
This song is about young people living in the northeast of America. Their lives are miserable because the steel factories are closing.
Жизнь их нищая и серая, потому что сталелитейный завод в этом городке закрывается.
They desperately want to leave, but they stay because they were brought up to believe that things were going to get better.
Им ужасно хочется уехать из этого городка, но их так воспитали, им все время говорили, что жизнь станет лучше. Оставайтесь, ребята.
The song is called Allentown.
Allentown.
And that whistle be up.
The kids in the crowd react to all this like they're seeing a fully staged American rock show for the first time, which they are. Joel and his band leave a strong first impression, and in the TV concert, their encore is perfect for the occasion and drives everybody into a rock and roll frenzy.
You like the Beatles?
Beatles, любите?
By reaching back almost 20 years, Joel has come up with the perfect anthem for his world stage concert. My only complaint is that the HBO special doesn't include his second encore, which reaches back even further and is an even more powerful choice. It's available, though, on the concert album that's being released, and if HBO won't use it as a finale, I will.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam. And admit that the waters around you have grown. And accept that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with novelist Ed McBain, who writes the 87th Precinct series of police procedurals. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile The Stooges, the Detroit proto-punk band, and book critic John Leonard will review Belfast Diary by Chicago journalist John Conroy. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.